Hello and welcome to the Ask the Geographer podcast series from the Department of Education and Outdoor Learning at the Royal Geographical Society with IBG. I'm Harry. In each podcast, I'll meet geographers from around the world to ask them about topical events, timely publications, and geographical research.
We're looking backward in this podcast to the 1800s with Professor Alice Reed from the Cambridge Group for the History of Population and Social Structure at the University of Cambridge. Alice is a historical demographer. She's written several papers on what British population was like around 150 years ago and created an interactive website of Victorian and Edwardian population, populationspast.org. The 19th century was a period of rapid socioeconomic advancement for Britain as we moved from a rural agricultural country to an urban industrialised powerhouse. At the time, Britain was the most powerful trading nation in the world, and the changes that occurred still echo in society today. Alice, welcome to the podcast and thanks for joining us. Firstly, what did the Cambridge Group for the History of Population and Social Structure do?
So you can call us CAMPOP for short, most people do, because it's a bit of a mouthful. So we're a research group that was established about 60 years ago by a group of geographers and historians who wanted to really find out about what the British population looked like at the past. Because at that time, there was an assumption that historical European populations would have looked like or had similar demographic and family regimes to those observed in much of Asia and Africa at the time. So really high fertility, really early marriage and many multi-generational households. And the members of CAMPOP developed a whole load of techniques for using parish registers, because this was before the registration of births and deaths and marriages, and it was before the introduction of censuses. They developed, so they were looking at a time before those things. Obviously, it was at a time when those things were well established, but they developed techniques for using parish registers, and those are church records of baptism and marriage and burial, to work out what populations look like. And they found that actually marriage patterns and household formation patterns were quite different to those seen in those places with high fertility and early marriage. And in the British past, in the pre-industrial period, already couples usually moved to their own household on marriage, and both men and women left home quite early, but had quite a long period of earning money in order to set up this new household. And so they married relatively late, and this kept birth rates down. And so Britain, and indeed much of Northern Europe, other people found, had quite moderate levels of fertility and also mortality. And this has been called the European marriage pattern, or the Northwest European marriage pattern. So this formative work on the British population in the past is really what CAMPOP started off doing, and one of the things it's still really well known for today. But it's only part of a much wider and ever-changing programme of research. So we've got other strands of research, people who look at occupational structure in Britain and further afield. And my own work mostly focuses on the 19th and 20th century, so a slightly later period, and using these sources like censuses and civil registration. And this is a really interesting period because this is the period of demographic transition, when fertility and mortality fell from those high but not very high levels to sort of low more stable, perhaps, levels. And I'm particularly interested in variation across the UK between urban and rural areas, between different types of urban areas, different parts of the country. And I'm interested in why birth and death rates fell among different social and spatial groups at different times, and the sort of the drivers of those differences.
You mentioned there that this is the start of low population rise and it becoming more stable. Today, we're going to look at three or four population traits of the period 1861 to 1890. Before we begin, can you paint a picture of what life was like then in Victorian Britain?
During the 19th century, well, you mentioned at the beginning that this was a time when Britain really industrialised. And in fact, it was already quite well established as an industrial society by the start of the 19th century. The Industrial Revolution is usually dated to have started about 1750, but urban growth really took off from about 1800. So the 19th century, 1800 to 1900, is the period when there was most urbanisation. in about 1800, about 30% of the population lived in urban areas, towns and cities, and some of them could have been quite small urban areas. And by 1900, about 80% of the population lived in towns and cities. And in fact, the population living in towns and cities today is very similar to that, not much more at all. So this is when most of the urbanization really happened. And this availability of urban industrial jobs made it easier to marry at slightly younger ages. This increased birth rates and therefore population growth. So the 19th century was a time of massive population growth as fertility increased, but mortality didn't start to fall until a little bit later, or started to fall very, very slowly. So it was a period of really rapid population growth over the country as a whole, but in urban areas particularly. And some of that urban growth was due to natural increase, to an excess of births over deaths, but a lot of it was also due to migration, the migration from the countryside, from rural areas to places where there was an increase in the number of jobs in towns and cities. So it was a time when people were more likely to be working in both industrial jobs, but also in the sort of service sector, in transport, in shopkeeping, and so on, in things like clerks and administrators. Most women worked before marriage, but over this period of time, it became less acceptable for women to work outside the home after they married.
It's so interesting that so many of those descriptions still persist today. They started in this period with service sector employment and urbanization. As you said, 80% of our population by 1900 in towns and cities, which is roughly similar to today's levels. Can we focus on fertility now? What can you tell us about fertility rates in the 1800s?
Yeah, well, the first thing to mention about fertility is just to clarify what we mean by fertility, and that's really important to do. So when demographers talk about fertility, they talk about achieved fertility or actual births. When other people talk about fertility, they might mean the potential to have children, and that's got a different word in demographic circles called fecundity, so we're not going to talk about that today. We talk about actual births. So I mentioned earlier that fertility in the pre-industrial period was moderately high. So that means an average woman might have had 4 or 5 children over the course of her lifestyle. But because quite a lot of women didn't marry in the British past, over 10 to 15% of women in England and Wales, up to 20% in Scotland of women never married, those births were sort of concentrated primarily among the people who did marry. So those who did marry had slightly more, maybe 5 children. On average, by the end of their life. Some women did have children outside marriage. Because of the data that we have, we know rather more about fertility among married women, but around 5 to 7% of births occurred outside marriage, and a considerable number of people were pregnant when they got married, so births were conceived before marriage. And starting from about the 1870s, 1880s, fertility rates started to decline. And initially, this was concentrated in the middle classes, but also among certain industrial groups like textile workers and people in textile working areas, such as Lancashire and West Yorkshire. And gradually, this decline, smaller families, was taken up amongst other groups. And it was slowest, though, among manual workers and among people in mining communities. And by the 1930s, fertility had fallen to below 2 children per woman. So this was a really rapid and fast decline, even though it happened at different times in different sectors of society.
I was just trying to rack my brains thinking, when did it drop below 2? And I was going to guess the end of the 20th century, but you're telling me it was much earlier.
Much earlier, yes. And this was a really fast decline. And then, of course, you know, it did rebound a bit. But one of the things is about this fertility decline is that, you know, that decline to the 1930s then in a way established this idea of demographic transition. It was in this sort of interwar period, the late interwar period, when fertility had fallen really low and mortality had also fallen by that stage, that people started to develop ideas of demographic transition, that there was this inevitable decline in fertility and mortality. And people then believed that fertility would remain at really low levels at about 2, you know, replacement rates, so that each generation would replace itself. And so they were really surprised when the baby boom came along and fertility rates, rebounded. And in a way, that's what provoked interest in historical demography, because people felt, well, you know, if we see this decline and then a rebound, you know, is there any precedent for this in the past? What did happen previously? We need to learn more about how things change in order to understand what's happening in the present.
And of course, in geography, we've got a very famous model, the demographic transition model, which has stages 4 and 5 and is still being studied and evolving. You studied London in particular. In 1801, it held about 10% of the population of England. By 1900, as we've discussed, that had rocketed up to about 15.5%. Can you describe fertility levels in London, the capital, then, and why they were as they were?
Yes. So in the 19th century, particularly, I'm going to start really in the mid 19th century, because we know most about the data from about, you know, the mid 19th century. Fertility in London was a bit lower than in the rest of the country. And primarily that's because there were quite a large proportion of middle class people in London. And those middle class people hadn't yet started to reduce their own fertility. But what happened was that they tended to employ a lot of young female servants, these young women who left home but hadn't yet married. And this increased the numbers of unmarried people who weren't having children. And when you calculate a fertility rate, you relate the numbers of births to the numbers of women who are available to have children. So when you're looking at overall fertility rates, that means these unmarried people pushed down fertility rates because they weren't having children. Many of these women will have then, you know, only been in London for a short space of time, or relatively short space of time. When they married and started a family, they would have done so perhaps elsewhere. Some of them might have stayed in London, but some of them would have moved away to do that. So this low fertility doesn't represent women who are never having children, but the fact that certain places are more attractive to people in the non-childbearing parts of their life cycle. And this sort of temporary migration also works to reduce fertility rates in some, you know, places like London today, when we see a lot of young people moving to London, you know, when they leave university to get jobs, and then they move away again later on when they reach a more stable part of their life cycle and possibly have children. They can't afford to live in London anymore.
It sounds like a very familiar story. I often describe the city as transient.
It's been like that for a long time. I mean, there's always a core of people who have lived in London and have been, you know, lived in London all their life, but it has this large body of people who move through, and that's always been the case.
And has that pattern always been uniform across the city?
It does vary quite substantially. So there's a lot of variation in London today, and that's similar to the past. And again, this is based on sort of the socioeconomic geography of the past. So as today, the West End of London is, on the whole, you know, there are variations, of course, but on the whole, wealthier than the East End. And fertility reflected this. So, for example, in Mayfair, in about 1851, women had already fewer than 2 children on average. A lot of that is because of the large numbers of unmarried women, and less than 1 child by 1901. Whereas in the East, in parts of the East End and Wapping in Shadwell, places like that, women had between 4 and 6 children per woman across the later 19th century. And a lot of that, at the beginning of this period, that's entirely to do with marriage patterns. It's entirely to do with the numbers of women at risk, and later marriage and less marriage in the West. But by the end of the 19th century, by 1901, fertility among married women in the West End of London had fallen, whereas it hadn't really started falling in the East. And this is quite similar to the geographic patterns today, where there's higher fertility in parts of the East End of London, although those bits with higher fertility have sort of moved outwards as London has increased in its geographical extent.
So would you describe high fertility areas now as suburban?
I think they're still quite urban. There are high fertility areas, but they're just, you know, when we talk about the extent of London, when we think about London in the 19th century, it's quite a small area compared to what we think of as London today, which has, you know, all those outer boroughs like, you know, Kingston in the south.
Is the downward trend of fertility consistent over time? You mentioned a moment ago that there was a bit of a wobble, that there's been variation since the mid-19th century.
Yeah, so the downward trend from about, you know, 1870 to 1930 was fairly consistent. And then there was this period of very low fertility in the 1930s. And then there was the baby boom, which is what, you know, disrupted people's thinking about demographic transition. usually people think of it as a post-war period, but in fact, the baby boom in the UK started during the war, when fertility rates started to increase during the Second World War and continued to be quite high until the mid-1960s. In the baby boom in the UK has got sort of two peaks, because part of it is a sort of catch-up growth by people who had delayed childbearing during the 1930s and in a way caught up some others who delayed childbearing during the war. And part of it is due to a generation of people who married at younger ages. So people who were marrying in the 1950s married really young. Marriage ages went down to unprecedentedly low levels for the UK. So people were marrying in their mid-20s, and more people were getting married. So those percentages of people who never married went down. And this meant that there were just more children, more people had one child, more people were available then to have two children and three children. So there was a sort of coalescence among this, on this two-child norm, but this produced a large number of extra children. And so there are various sort of demographic reasons why the baby boom happened, but what we're less sure about is why people started getting married at younger ages during that period. The baby boom stopped quite suddenly in this sort of late 1960s, early 1970s, and this is likely to be related to the introduction of the contraceptive pill. And this is really interesting because this reduction in fertility related to contraception is quite different to why fertility declined and how fertility declined from 1870 to 1930, because that doesn't appear to have been related to any provision of contraception at all. Most people achieved lower fertility within marriage then through traditional means like withdrawal and abstinence, rather than using the rather uncomfortable and unpleasant and expensive methods of modern contraception, which were beginning to come available at that point in time.
Fertility was clearly influenced by wealth. Were fatality rates also in the 19th century?
Well, yeah, again, the 19th century in a way saw the emergence of wealth or income as an influence on mortality rates, because in the sort of pre-industrial past, actually, there were very little social class differences in mortality. And in a way, this is due to the introduction of better medicine and better knowledge about disease. And it's only really once you can understand how to prevent disease and to be able to do things to prevent disease, that actually social class, that wealth can actually make a difference. In the middle of the 19th century, there were big differences by mortality, particularly infant mortality, according to wealth or social status. But these actually had, in a way, they had their roots in place, in where people lived, in the disease environments and the local amenities, rather than through the advantage which money could buy. So, for example, in the overcrowded areas of inner cities, where public provision of water and sanitation hadn't really kept up with population growth, and where maybe the air was polluted by factory smoke or in mining areas by coal dust, and where infectious diseases could easily be transmitted from person to person, middle-class people living in these areas were at similar risk of mortality to the poorer people living in these areas. And there weren't many middle-class people who chose to live in those areas. And in a way, that's why these social class differences are visible when you look at the aggregate level. And so on the flip side for that, when you look in the countryside, the survival of farm labourers who may have had very insecure work contracts and maybe not much money at all, their survival was very similar to that of farmers and landowners who employed them. And particularly when I'm talking about these, we know most about infant mortality in this period. So wealthy people could afford to live in the nicer places, where wealthy people did live in the less nice places and where poorer people did live in the nicer places, they echoed the mortality rates of the places they lived.
Is it important to distinguish between infant mortality and child mortality rates in these urban areas that you mentioned around factories or in poor air quality areas?
Yeah, well, age is a really important determinant of mortality. Today, mortality rates are highest among the elderly, but infants and particularly newborns are still at higher risk. And these risks of age in the past were even higher, particularly the risks associated with very young age. So mortality rates have always been highest soon after birth, the first day, the first week, the first month, and they gradually decrease over childhood. And what's really interesting about that is that these reflect different influences and different causes. So Partly the high mortality of very young infants is to do to biological vulnerability, but also the different types of risk that infants and children are exposed to. So really, young infants can be affected by their mother's health during pregnancy or by a difficult birth, for example. But they are also protected in some ways. They're protected against infectious diseases by immunity, which they carry with them, their mother's immunity, which they carry with them for a few months and then which declines. They can also be protected by breastfeeding if they're breastfed, and that means they're not exposed to dangerous pathogens carried by water or food. And the earlier children are weaned, the more vulnerable they are to diarrhea and for food and waterborne diseases. And so children in the first weeks and month of life die from quite different causes to those in the later part of the first year of life. And then in the second and third years of life and slightly later bits of childhood, infectious diseases take over as the main influence on mortality. And because these different causes of death are then affected by different aspects of society. So very small infants can be affected by care during birth, by midwifery, and by the health of their mothers and the nutritional status of their mothers. Older infants are more at risk from food and waterborne diseases, which they might pick up when they went during weaning, and by airborne diseases, by transmission of infectious diseases from siblings, from people in the neighbourhood, and so on. So we can tell quite a lot when we look from the age patterns of mortality or by the cause patterns of mortality. We can tell a lot about the causes of those mortalities and what's likely to be influencing mortality.
And returning to migration, did migration affect either of these population traits, so fertility or fatality rates, as in lifelong migration?
Well, in a way, lifelong migration is the only thing that we can really tell much about for this period, because our information on migration mostly comes from the census, which records where people are born but doesn't record all the places they went in between their recording in the census. But migration is really, really important. It's really important in determining the population size in different places, but also in affecting fertility and mortality. And I've already described a little bit about how it affects fertility rates in the migration of young women into cities, which then pushes down observed fertility rates. But it can also have an effect in other ways. For example, let's think about mining areas. So mining areas had a lot of job opportunities for young men. They were really growing during this period. So there was a lot of migration to mining areas. Women migrated to mining areas as well, but there weren't many job opportunities for them. So this altered the marriage markets. Fewer women migrated, which meant that those women that were there were more men competing for them. They tended to get married earlier and therefore to have more children. There was no incentive for them in a way to stay unmarried because there were fewer job opportunities. So migration is there, you know, influencing fertility outcomes, although, you know, in a way they're both driven by the economic structure of the area. And migration probably also helped to spread the decline of fertility. So I mentioned earlier that the middle classes were the earliest to reduce their fertility, but they were also the most likely to migrate. And they tended to migrate further than the working classes. And so this is one way that new ideas about fertility control and about the acceptability of reducing your family size and about new ways of childbearing and the desirability of having small families might have spread is through new migrants coming to an area. And migration is also really important for mortality. So migrants tend to be more healthy than people who don't migrate. And part of that's a sort of, you know, if you've got some sort of long-term condition or a disability, it may be more difficult for you to migrate. But generally, migrants tend to be young, educated, and healthy. And this can, just by the fact that they migrate, can affect mortality rates in both the place that they leave, because the removal of the healthy people means that overall mortality rates there will be a little bit worse, and the places that they go to. On the other hand, there are other things that migration can do. So if migrants from the countryside haven't been exposed to various infectious diseases as children, and then they've moved to a place where they are more exposed, where those infectious diseases are more common, they might be actually more vulnerable from dying from them. Or they might contract a chronic disease such as tuberculosis in a town or city. Tuberculosis was a major killer of young adults in the 19th century, but it's a chronic disease, so it lasted a long time. You might get sick from tuberculosis, become unable to work, and return to your rural area to die. So there are a lot of complex issues with migration, which can affect mortality. And in a way, we don't know enough about that. But really, to really understand that, we need data which follow people over time, follow individuals over time, to learn about how these relationships between migration and mortality really work.
What changes occurred through this time socially? And we've talked about the economic impact on mining towns, and we've obviously discussed London in detail. But how did society change from 1850 onwards? And what was the impact of industrialization?
So this was a period of really major social change, as well as demographic and economic change. And to some extent, these processes are all connected. So industrialization really changed the economic structure of the society, and indeed the years leading up to industrialization. So the sort of 200 years leading up to the Industrial Revolution actually already saw smaller proportions of people working in agriculture and fishing, and more in industry. But this was mainly small-scale industry, people working in workshops and in their homes and in a non-mechanized way. And during the Industrial Revolution, that industry changed to being more mechanized and arranged more in larger factories and mills. This meant that actually the proportions working in manufacture didn't change much during the period, but the way that they worked changed a lot. And what changed in terms of industrial structure during the Industrial Revolution was a further decrease in the proportions working in agriculture. There was a sort of agricultural revolution at the same time, and a big increase, as I mentioned earlier, in the service sector, transport, warehousemen, clerks, shopkeepers, traders, food and drink providers, and so on. And, you know, these changes also brought things like the development of free education and universal education. They increased the proportion of people who we might think of as middle class. And this is a sort of more of a structural change in society rather than what we might think of as social mobility, although it might have had the same sort of effect. And this will have affected aspirations and exposure to new ideas in a really big way as well.
What I've taken from this conversation is that it's amazing how much of what we're talking about has contemporary application or is still ongoing as a process. What would you say to finish with is the enduring legacy of this period on British life? I know that's a huge question, but we could try and hone in on a few points.
Yeah, it's a massive question. And I think, you know, every historian of this period or geographer, historical geographer would answer it in a different way. I'm going to focus on, you know, population. So I think one of the things about this period is that it really altered the population distribution of the country. So what the Industrial Revolution did in a way, it was that it concentrated population around places with particular sources of power. And initially this was sort of rivers and streams, which enabled water power to feed textile mills and so on in the north and west. Before the Industrial Revolution, there weren't such enormous concentrations of people around Manchester and those sorts of areas of Lancashire and West Yorkshire. And then around places where, of course, coal was produced and used. So there's a really important function of the Industrial Revolution in affecting the population distribution. And because those cities were built up, that's still where a lot of our housing stock is. That's where people live. And then, of course, the fact that these industrial centres were dominated by a small number of industries or sometimes even single industries, that meant that they were really particularly hard hit by deindustrialization in the 20th century. And that's affected migration. And so now instead of being migration areas, those mining areas in South Wales and in the Northeast used to be in the 19th century were areas which received a lot of migrants. Now they're areas which send a lot of migrants. And, you know, we talked about migration and mortality and the healthy migrant effect, an educated migrant effect. This has the effect of keeping places which have experienced deindustrialization in a cycle of sort of disadvantage. And these processes are really difficult to turn around, and because there's a sort of really real stickiness to them in the sort of housing there is, in investment, in where the people want to move there or want to move away. And I think this is one of the real lasting legacies of the Industrial Revolution and of the 19th century.
It's a really interesting point to finish on. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to the Ask the Geographer podcast series on iTunes and SoundCloud.com. Be inspired and stay informed with the Society's wide range of resources, many of which are free. School membership unlocks access to other excellent resources, including online lectures and many other tailor-made benefits for teachers and students. Access our resources at www.rgs.org/schools.